brought to you by the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. As part of our Free Market Environmentalism Workshop, this episode features Rick Geddes presenting on congestion pricing.
So I want to start off with another note of thanks on this project that I'm doing with Dimitar Nenchev, who is a Cornell econ grad of a few years ago and is now AIG was mentioned, I think, by Michael a little bit. And Dimitar is now working at AIG, or was working until recently at AIG, and they missed his reapplication for his visa by 1 week. So he has to leave the country, but he's going to the London Business School to get his equivalent of an MBA from the LSE. So Dimitar is just an amazing, amazing guy. Please keep your eye on him over time. But I want to thank also John Foote for the inspiration and support for this. Nobody knows probably who John Foote is, but I want to talk about John Foote for a minute because I think it's so relevant for what has been discussed at this meeting. John Foote is Cornell class of 74 president, graduated in 74, big Cornell booster, got an engineering degree from Cornell, but decided, or I think civil, but early on decided that he wasn't going to be a star engineer. And he went, like a lot of engineers, into finance, into business. And he was with Citibank when it was Citibank for many years, helping governments throughout Southeast Asia raise sovereign debt for public sector projects. So he did public finance for a long time. Then he went off with a bunch of his buddies to start an investment company. I guess they were all other Cornell friends. And they, you know, invested people's money in an assortment of things. And, you know, they had a fairly decent-sized portfolio. And he said one day they just took a look at their portfolio, and they realized, they said, as they had cats and dogs, was what they said, just an unfocused sort of portfolio of investments. They had a toilet-making company, for example, that they invested in. They had this other company that made and serviced toll road equipment. So it was the old baskets where you would ride up and you would throw the coins into the basket, and it would go down and measure how much money, and you know, there's actually some technology in that. And they had a group of civil engineers that was involved with that. And one of his partners heard about this company, and the company was in Texas, and it had this technology. And the technology was used on cows, and it was a thing you hooked on Bessie's ear, a tag, and Bessie would go into the barn. So Dean is eating this up with the ag applications here. And Bessie would go into the barn, and an overhead reader would know that Bessie had gone into the barn, and it would dispense her food, and it would measure how much milk she gave, and it would give her exactly the right diet. And it was all done through this overhead technology that read this. But they weren't making any money at it in this agricultural application. And so they took that, John's company, purchased that technology from this company in Texas, and they gave it to these engineers that were working on one of the few investments that they kept, which was the toll equipment collection and maintenance and installation company. And they said to these guys, can you do something with this transponder technology? And so these mechanical and civil engineers fiddled around with it. They said, hey, we can put this in a car, and the transponder can be in the car, and the overhead reader will be on a gantry overhead, and you won't have to pay a toll when you go by. And so that was EasyPass. That was the creation of EasyPass, was this ag technology on the cow's ear. And John's company then became TransCore, is the company that created EasyPass. So John and his buddies then sold TransCore once, bought it back later on, and now if you look at TransCore on the web, you'll see it's an international toll road operating company. So John has now been a tremendous supporter of these. He's an enviropreneur. I would love somebody to be able to calculate the environmental benefits of not having to stop to pay a toll of EasyPass. The next thing now is interoperability of those transponders across the whole U.S. That's where we're headed. So, you know, SunPass is in Florida. But so you don't have to worry about that operability as you move along. So John has been a great supporter of this, and we're hoping to do a lot more with these public-private partnerships, which interact with tolling. So this work with Dimitar is an attempt to come up with a new approach to using a financial structure, which Dino and I talked about almost a year ago, to encourage the pricing or tolling of unpriced transportation capacity. So that's really the goal here. So when Dino started off with his comments at the very beginning of this conference, they resonated with me because of the importance of, you know, the market mechanism for this extraordinarily valuable asset that we have in the United States that has sometimes been called the greatest public works project after the pyramids. I guess we could argue as to whether or not the U.S. interstate system rivals the pyramids, but by any standard, it's enormous. The latest measure I could get was 2010, which is 47,182 miles of interstate system, which Cliff Winston at Brookings, who I'm a huge fan of, actually getting the value of that is non-trivial. What's it worth, right? Well, since it's not priced, we really don't have a market value, and you have to impute it. And the economists that have done this, well, have disagreed on the methodology, but Cliff thinks about $2.5 trillion is the value. Notice that I'm not including the state highway system, and there's something broader than the interstates, which is called the federal aid highway system, monies that get federal aid. If we include that, our transportation system, this enormously valuable, obviously important asset for moving people and goods around the country. And the United States, you know, arguably has the best system for doing that. But only, about 2,900 miles of that total are currently tolled. Those are toll roads mostly in the Northeast that were grandfathered in the 1956 Act that created the interstate system, or toll roads that were in the process of being built when the Act was passed. But one of the goals of President Eisenhower when the interstate system was implemented was to have it be non-tolled because it was supposed to be a high-speed set of roads with, you know, limited access where you didn't have to stop to pay a toll. So this was well before the days of Easy Pass, although I'm told that President Eisenhower actually would have liked to have seen it be tolled. Transportation is an enormously important expenditure for people. There's a new Treasury study out last week which says for 99% of U.S. households, they spend about $1 out of every $7 on transportation-related expenses, and it works out to about $7,600 per household annually, which beats food or health care. So it's clearly an important expenditure, a very valuable asset, but it's operated horribly, right? And I'm sure everyone in this room knows why. It's the lack of market mechanism to allocate the use of that extremely important asset and a direct investment into or out of that asset. The Treasury study indicates, and the Texas Transportation Institute agrees, about 1.9 billion gallons of gas are wasted annually by Americans sitting in congested traffic. It costs drivers a total of over $100 billion annually in wasted fuel and time. And there's a new literature now on the harms stemming from traffic congestion. And it's a lot bigger than people previously thought. The Curry and Walker study from 2011 got a lot of press about babies who develop near congested roads have worse health outcomes. So it affects babies. Fine particulates. There's new epidemiological work showing that fine particulates associated with traffic congestion have really severe health, long-term health effects that we didn't think of before. A few studies showing, of course, that cities with more congested traffic are less productive cities in some sense because people are spending time sitting in traffic and not at work or at rest or something else they could do. Other studies from Europe showing greater obesity rates associated with longer commutes, higher divorce rates. So really a lot of demand-side issues associated with the problems with traffic congestion. What I consider to be the supply-side problems, I think, are equally as problematic. There's this famous thing that the American Society of Civil Engineers comes out with every year called the Infrastructure Report Card. Gets a ton of press. They, you know, give it A through F kind of grades. I think our roads and bridges get a D, basically. They rate 32% of our roads in poor, mediocre condition. I can go into the bridges and tunnels as well. Pretty much everybody in this room is familiar with infrastructure problems, potholes, et cetera, have a big effect on the maintenance costs of our vehicles, and the Treasury estimate is about $400 annually per motorist, or $67 billion annually total. And, of course, the other supply-side problem that people don't often link to this, but I think is linked, is the misallocation of a lot of transportation resources. Now, I actually think state DOTs and all, they do a pretty good job. They try hard. These are dedicated, true public servants trying hard to do well with the limited resources they have from gas tax revenue. But we're all familiar with the federal level where every time you buy a gallon of gas, 18.4 cents of that gallon goes to the feds. They reallocate the spending every 5 to 6 years in a big highway bill. A few weeks ago, Congress reauthorized it for 2 years. Normally, they do 5 to 6. The last big one was 2005 Safety Lou highway bill. That was the one that had the Bridge to Nowhere in it, which was the poster child for misallocation of resources bridge in Alaska that was never built. But what people don't know is that bill contained 6,371 earmarks in it. Now, some of those earmarks may have passed cost-benefit muster, but there's no mechanism that basically short-circuits executive branch review of this, and there's no real mechanism to ensure that. So the direction of investment, which we normally associate with prices, price signals guiding supply, is not existent here. So you get these sorts of problems, which, of course, make politicians loathe to raise fuel taxes to fund additional investment in infrastructure. So this is one of these areas where economists sort of know the answer, right? Just price it, right? This goes back to Vickery. I mean, this goes back to William Vickery and writings in the 60s and to Walters in the early 60s that, you know, the way to solve this, and they thought they could see, they could smell that the technology was out there. They knew it would come, but it wasn't there at that time. But they said, what you've got to do is to variably price the use of the roads. And, you know, that you could think of that price as including a congestion charge, which is, sorry, the externality associated that one driver imposes on another that they don't take into account in their own choice of driving. But variable road prices, or VMT, vehicle miles traveled charges, can take into account a whole bunch of other effects, other costs, like the marginal effect you have on wearing out the road. This is also much better in light of electric vehicles and hybrids that get extremely good gas mileage, but don't pay anywhere close to their cost that they impose on the roads, okay? But we think we know the economic solution to this because it gives the right incentive for motorists to conserve on the use of the roads in any way they see fit. We often see these programs where they say, ride your bike more, carpool more, walk, take public transit. Well, the economist says, just give the right price signals and then let people figure out, subject to that price signal, what the best way is for them. Slugging is one way, you know, how moving closer to work, whatever it may be. Let them, Ian Perry has pointed this out, in detail, let them decide. On the supply side, of course, it's not as often emphasized, but a variable vehicle miles travel charge, it gives you the signal as to where investment, so where are people willing to pay the highest prices to use the road, that's where the investment ought to flow into infrastructure. So, you know, the term is, in the literature, this avoids white elephant projects, you know. The thinking now, if you talk to guys who have been doing this forever, like Bob Poole, who I love out at the Reason Foundation, is that you can price new capacity. So if you add a lane, you can make it a hot lane. So that's high occupancy or toll. So you have the right number of people or you pay the toll. And you can then get people to accept pricing of that lane. But if you're the politician who comes along and says, have I got a deal for you? You drive now on I-95 twice a day. It's free, quote unquote, but I'm going to charge you a VMT fee. You can imagine that in the next election, you're going to have your head handed to you on a plate by your opponent because people don't want to pay for something that they perceive, you know, was free before. It's like double, you know, double taxation. It's unfair, et cetera, et cetera. So the challenge in the transportation literature now is getting to the point where you overcome political resistance to pricing currently unpriced transportation capacity. So it's like everybody sort of has to weigh in now on this. So Dimitar and I have weighed in. This is a little bit different than what economists normally think of, because we don't care what you do with the revenue in some sense. We say just get the pricing in, right? Get the darn thing priced and you'll get the supply signals, you'll get the demand signals, you know, you'll raise revenue from the toll, but that's not really what, you know, basic micro is about. It's about the efficiency of allocation you get from the variable pricing that Vickery, may rest in peace, envisioned for so many years. However, economists have risen to the occasion and suggest a number, and others, and urban planners, people in engineering have suggested a number of different alternatives for this. And this is kind of where the literature is now. Ken Small suggested using a portion of the new toll revenue to reduce taxes in the toll region. A colleague of mine is Mike Manville in City and Regional Planning at Cornell. He wrote this 2007 piece suggesting that it should go to the governments through the newly tolled region. You raise the revenue, and then you sort of buy off the governments with that, and that would get support. There's a woman who's I've only briefly met. Her name is Carol Kokelman. She's down at UT Austin. She's a civil engineer, and she's done tremendous work on this using something called credit-based congestion pricing, where basically you measure average use, and you just give credits back to the motorists for the average road use. So if you use the road less than average, you get to bank these credits over time, presumably transfer them at some point. And if you use the road more than average, you pay on the margin. So the motorist bears that marginal effect. So this credit-based congestion pricing that she's done, surveys in the Austin area to see if people will buy into it, find some support. So she suggested that. Dimitar and I want to kind of do two things at once. If you think about what happens if you could get variable pricing implemented, basically that the system becomes like a public utility. That's kind of the model that you think about, where you pay per kilowatt hour of electricity, per therm of natural gas, per minute of cell phone use. Now you're paying per vehicle miles traveled. Well, that makes it kind of like a utility, which means that you can get private investment involved. So just a little bit of quick background on public-private partnerships. This is the cutting edge. The U.S. is way behind other countries. Canada, per dollar of GDP, has seven times more private investment in transportation infrastructure than we do. Canada. The Europeans have three and a half times in the European Union. More than the United States has per dollar of GDP. So public-private partnerships are simply contractual agreements between the public project sponsor and a private entity to fund some piece of transportation infrastructure. So this Federal Highway Administration definition is standard. They come in two broad flavors, greenfields and brownfields. Greenfield is new construction, where you do it with a PPP. You get private investors who actually have an equity interest. There's a lot of leverage, a lot of debt involved in these typically. Building new capacity on the DC Beltway on the Northern Virginia side, a consortium of Fluor and Transurban are doing those lanes without any government money, purely as a greenfield PPP, where they're adding those tolled lanes to the Northern Virginia Beltway. We want to talk about brownfields, much more controversial. Brownfield is a lease of an existing transportation asset, and you know, typically it's tolled already, so there's a revenue stream associated with that asset, and then you do a long-term lease that generates a big upfront concession payment as a result of that. So this, I think, fits in nicely with what Kent was talking about regarding new asset classes in the environmental area, like timber, real estate. They have different risk-return profiles relative to stocks and bonds. They are called alternative investments, typically inflation-protected, because oftentimes the toll rate can go up at a CPI escalator. So the investor then gets a inflation-protected asset that they will add to their stocks and bonds. So long-term folks like pensions and mutual funds that have these liabilities out 20, 30 years are getting very interested in CalPERS. Other people like that are getting very interested in investing in infrastructure in the United States. It's not a question of the investment. So this is kind of our discussion. It's not a question of the investors being interested. It's a question of the deals, of the amount, the opportunities to invest in the U.S. And we can talk about why the U.S. is so far behind. Just to give you some examples of our focus on U.S. brownfields, a couple of examples. Governor Indiana Mitch Daniels did a 75-year lease of the Indiana Toll Road, received a $3.8 billion payment from a consortium of Macquarie and Cintra is the Spanish toll road operating company in a competitive bidding situation. He put that money aside in a fund that was paid down over 10 years called Major Moves to Fund Transportation Projects All Over the State. That made Indiana the best-funded transportation program in the country because of that upfront lease payment. People think that the investors pay too much. Governor Daniels says, fine, you know, better for my state. The more controversial one was the lease of the Chicago Skyway in March of 2004, a 99-year lease. They received $1.83 billion upfront concession payment, and I think it was the same Macquarie-Cintra team in a project financing that did that. That was, I'll talk about why that was more controversial. What was even sadder, though, was Governor Rendell. I don't know if people know, but Governor Rendell is sort of like a tank moving along, decided he was going to lease the Pennsylvania Turnpike, which is the largest piece of toll road in the U.S., and this was before the 2008 financial crisis, and received tremendous bids. Again, the Spanish are very big in this. The Australians are big on the banking side. They generated a $12.8 billion bid for a 75-year lease of the Pennsylvania Turnpike, but because Governor Rendell didn't bring the legislature along and sort of massage them the way he should have, they vetoed the deal after several rounds of bidding, which I think was very sad because the state didn't get that money. Plus, the Spanish, I understand, were very, very discouraged by this political machination. Typically, it's a special purpose vehicle with project financing involved. So I won't. The key thing politically, though, is how do you use the proceeds from the lease? And Governor Daniels is considered to have done a good job by putting this away in this 10-year program dedicated to transportation. The Skyway is the poster child for a bad brownfield lease because the city it was like two-thirds of the city budget for that year. They used it to plug a budget hole to retire a bunch of debt, including Skyway debt. They also used it for homeless shelters and things like that. There's nothing wrong with homeless shelters, but there's problems with people perceiving money for transportation going to sort of non-transportation uses. Now, Governor Rendell, I want to emphasize in Pennsylvania in particular, because that's closest to what Dimitar and I are proposing. He would have placed the money in the state pension fund, walling off that upfront lease payment, which I understand is very well managed at arm's length by very good managers in the state of Pennsylvania, and he would have used all the income from that to pay for transportation projects around the state forever. And that was before the financial crisis when they were thinking of a 8% annual return or something, which ended up being $1.1 billion a year, something like that. But that concept inspired Dimitar and I to take it a step further and to formalize it. I don't want to blather on too much. But we figured, why not formalize the Governor Rendell concept, even though he didn't get it done because of the legislature? And where could we look for that concept? Well, it turns out, in several jurisdictions in the U.S., there's the use of this thing called a permanent fund. And this is a real structure that's governed by the Government Accounting Standards Board Rule 24 and other, you know, other rules that is used in Alaska, Texas, and Norway to preserve natural resource wealth for the people forever. This was done in Alaska in reaction to the North Slope oil leases, where the state wasted the money really quickly in a couple of years on a bunch of, you know, low return projects. And the people of Alaska said, enough. They said, we want this preserved in perpetuity, and they got it in the Constitution. So it's actually in the Alaskan Constitution how the permanent fund is going to be structured. It's invested in a diversified portfolio very successfully. And this is, you know, lease revenue. But the important thing is that in Alaska, every single person, if you're an Alaskan, men, women, and children, you get a dividend check every year generated from the income from that fund. If you can look on the web, at around $1,400 per person recently. And this has, people are really heavily invested in this fund in Alaska. So if a politician, so the principle is protected in the Constitution, but the dividends are not. So it would be possible in some legal sense for a politician to divert the dividends to a different purpose. That is considered political suicide in Alaska. If you mess with that dividend check, you are in deep doo-doo. There was, I could go into details about that, about the citizen stakeholdership in the fund, but the more reading Dimitar and I did on this, the more we were impressed with really how this permanent fund model created people invested in this fund idea. So we said, why not use lease payments from brownfield PPP concessions, where you're getting these big upfront payments, and preserve that for the citizens of the relevant jurisdiction forever. And, you know, build it on the Alaskan, because everybody, we, in some sense, we all own the infrastructure. It's a public asset. What does that mean? Well, it means when the value is extracted through a PPP, we should get that value. And we could do that in perpetuity. And this is not as insane as it may sound initially, because it's what Governor Rendell would have proposed, except the dividends in our proposal would go for, the income would go for dividends instead of for transportation. So we propose 60, 70%, whatever it is, let the politicians work it out, of the upfront payment is going to go into the permanent fund for that jurisdiction. The balance of it is the political grease. It's the candy. It's the honey for the politicians to say, we are interested in doing this. We want the ribbon-cutting ceremonies now before the next election. And, you know, we're going to get the new interchange on the interstate. We're going to get the new tunnel, the new bridge. And I'll stand there with a photo and cut the ribbon. And then I'll be reelected, and I will be interested in your IP3. Right? So that's kind of the idea of not putting the 100% of the concession payment in there. So there's, I'll just give you the, I know folks may not be, you know, as interested in the transportation sector, so I'll just tell you what problems and concerns this has raised, because Dimitar and I have presented this in front of some transportation experts. Some people argue that this, and, you know, I'll be interested to hear your views. Some people argue that this is problematic because you're giving the value from the roads to non-motorists. It's going to all households, not all of whom use the roads. So in some sense, those people paying the tolls are paying for these dividend payments to non-users. Now, others who are also really knowledgeable say, no, these guys, these other guys are wrong. Think of this like an IPO. And basically, if you build up a value of a company, you take it public, you get the revenue from the IPO, you can do whatever the heck you want with the IPO money, right? No, there's no constraint on that. So in some sense, we have all built up the U.S. interstate system. That value is there. It's extracted through a PPP. We should be able to do whatever the heck we want with the value that comes out of that IPO. So that's one argument here. Others, Bob Poole is a big proponent of this, argue that the concession proceeds should be used only for highway projects. He doesn't like any diversion of it's a he's very into user pay, doesn't want any diversion from the toll, you know, the user pay concept, from the toll revenue to funding that facility. So he doesn't want money to go to transit or any of these other things, whereas I'm sort of saying, hey, Bob, let's do whatever the politicians want to do with that 40% of the concession payment just to get the deal done. Because what we're trying to do is to get the pricing implemented. And that's the, you know, that's the goal. Here's a where I would love some feedback from you guys. Which form of payments is less likely to be subject to political manipulation? A one-time upfront concession fee payment that you get through a PPP, or a stream of payments over time where you share in the revenue from the toll, and say you just use revenue sharing to give the dividend to households directly? Okay, now Bob Poole and I have gone back and forth. He thinks that the upfront lump sum payment is going to be subject to a political principal agent problem, whereas I think, Dimitar and I think, that that's an advantage of the PPP, is that you do this one-time transfer into a permanent fund, and then it's away from the political process, just like in Alaska. So anyway, that's, you know, there's different flavors of this sort of thing. Another question I would have for you is one person, Bill Reinhart, who edits something called Public Works Financing. It's a monthly newsletter out of Jersey. Says, Rick, why don't you make the shares transferable? In other words, give people shares in the fund where they could cash out instead of the dividend. And I said, well, maybe. You know, I'd have to think that through. So maybe that would get more political buy-in. So those are some advantages we think of the investment PPP approach relative to some of the ideas that have been out there. Big part of it is reducing agency problems between the politicians and the citizens. There's a big equity effect of this that's recognized in Alaska, because that dividend payment out of the Alaskan Permanent Fund is progressive in the sense that every household gets the same dollar amount, so that's a bigger fraction of lower-income households. So I could go on and on. And we have a model in the back of the paper. So Columbus we used because Ohio DOT was just wonderful in giving us data on sensors throughout the Columbus area, which we think is sort of a moderately congested area. It's not, D.C. in terms of congestion or the New York metro area, but it still apparently is pretty congested. And these red dots are where we have sensor data for different types of traffic, so trucks, vans, buses, cars, and we can measure those throughout every 24-hour interval throughout the day to get traffic counts. And this, you know, this is actually really very detailed. And Dimitar was terrific in using all of the traffic sensors here to try to get some handle on what would be a reasonable upfront concession fee to pay because of the rents that are available from congestion prices. And we ran through some models. I won't go through this. I'll just get to the bottom line here. We ran through some models where we used 15-year concession lengths, which an investment guy told me is too short because the investors want to match the payout to their liability, so they want 20 to 30-year leases, which means these numbers are actually kind of low. And we also, John Foote told me that we should calculate these things that were a little bit new for me and Dimitar, which are called levels of service. So the engineers have grades that they assign to traffic flow, where A is free flow traffic, F is bumper to bumper traffic, and you have these grades in between. Because John said, look, Rick, if you're going to price the road, what are you giving motorists? You better give them better flowing traffic, right? So, you know, I did take my civil engineering classes. You got to give me level of service numbers. So Dimitar went through and ran these grades to sort of see what our tolls, which we borrowed from the SR-71 express lanes in Southern California, applied them to figure out how levels of service would improve, and you can see we don't get much improvement. So the engineers told me that a move from E to D is actually a big, we would perceive that as a big improvement in traffic, traffic flows as from F to E. But still, what this means is that our tolls are not sharp enough. In other words, we should be pricing in a more serious way to get to better levels of service. And just over the past couple of days, Dimitar ran the numbers for getting you, you know, out to 2025 to much better levels of service in Columbus. And what that does, of course, is generates a bigger upfront payment, bigger rents, right? And that means that these numbers in terms of dividends per household in the Columbus area would be higher, okay? So what I want you to do is to sort of think of these as low, pretty low estimates. So we're probably getting pretty close to the Alaska Permanent Fund level of dividends for the Columbus area if you do serious congestion pricing. We also ran these models where we said, forget the permanent fund approach, just spend down the principal, right? So the declining principal approach, then when you release the road 15, 20 years from now, you get the upfront payment again, you'd spend down the principal. So then you're talking about $1,400, over $1,400 per household in the Columbus area, okay? So this this is our contribution to, you know, trying to overcome these political obstacles. I'll just tell you one problem with this is that the states actually own the interstate system. The states own the interstate system. And Bob Poole told me that he thought this idea of going to Columbus and saying you're going to price out Columbus and give that value to the people of Columbus is going to drive the state of Ohio bonkers because they're going to want the revenue from this pricing. They're not going to sit still for that. So that this is a legal jurisdictional issue that I want you to be aware of. But Dimitar and I were trying to get the concept out there, right, first. And maybe there's a way of solving that. So I'll just stop with that.
To learn more about free market environmentalism, visit www.perc.org.